Good morning, agus fáilteas teach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. I am so honored this morning on This Irish American Life to share with you a wonderful recent event which took place in honor of the late Mick Maloney. An evening entitled Mind Yourself took place in collaboration with the Tenement Museum of New York. His longtime friend Lenny Sloan shared with me a platform with some of Mick's closest musical collaborators. We were in the presence of Athena Turgis, Dan Neely, Brenda Castles, Liz Hanley, Brendan Dolan, and Anne Cullerton. And this event was broadcast from inside historically recreated 1860s parlor of the Irish tenement family who are connected to the tenement museum called the Moors. In the course of this event, we heard reflections on Mick and his contributions to scholarship and to the world of arts, and to the interconnections of the Black and Irish experience, the African American and Irish American experience. And we also had some wonderful musical tributes which spoke to his presence amongst us. Lenny, as I mentioned, was a longtime collaborator, is a longtime collaborator of Mick's. And it was just such an honor to be with Lenny during the important few days of Mick's funeral events and memorial events which were taking place in New York City. And I'm really honoured that I'm able to, this morning on This Irish American Life, share with you all some of the proceedings of that event. You can actually watch this event if you'd like to do so later on or to share with your friends. It is available through the YouTube channel of the Tenement Museum, and I'm very grateful for their permission and the team led by the wonderful Annie Polland, who was behind all of this and marking Mick's passing in a space which was very important to him. So over the next 50 odd minutes or so, you're going to hear much of what was discussed and performed in the tenement that evening, that special September evening, as we remembered someone who has left his mark, who has changed how we look at Irish America and culture and arts and performance in ways that were really unimaginable before he was in this space.
I had the good fortune of working with Mick at NYU for a number of years. And while we weren't close friends, we really respected each other as colleagues, and it was a deep honour for me to facilitate Lenny and the others with this wonderful event. So I'm going to hand over now to a musical tribute to Mick Maloney, and I hope you enjoy this on This Irish American Life. So sit back, folks. There's a lot going on and it is a lot of fun. Enjoy.
Oh, when the saints go marching in, go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, Lord, I want to be in that number, y'all, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in, go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, Lord, I want to be in that number, y'all, when the saints go marching.
Good evening, Lenny, and welcome to the Tenement Museum, where we are here for a wakeful moment of celebration of our friend and colleague and collaborator, the wonderful Mick Maloney. I'm really honoured to be here and I'm delighted with that wonderful introduction from Kat and all our colleagues at the Tenement Museum. We're here in this very historic space and very meaningful space for all of us with immigrant connections here on the Lower East Side, remembering Mick. In the room with us, the place is oozing with talent. Specifically, we have Athena Turgis, Liz Hanley, Brenda Castles, Dan Neely, Brendan Dolan, and Anna Culleton. And it is my honour to be here with the venerable Lenny Sloan, someone who has been a long-time collaborator with Mick, and someone for whom the interconnectedness of the African-American and Irish-American experience have formed an intellectual sharing and exchange that has enriched us all. Lenny, you opened this evening with the wonderful support of these really fabulously talented mentees, I think, of Mick, we could say, as we remember him in a ritualistic way. It's something that's very strong in the Irish tradition, as Mick has studied it, and as you in the African-American tradition, and as you've brought them together. tell us a little bit about that ritual and the wake and how you have come to unpack it and be with us here this evening as we remember Mick.
Thank you very much. I'm here with friends who sat around the table with Mick in the last days of his life, sharing meals together. You know, the root word of companion is compane, to break bread together, with bread. And we spent our, what we thought were endless days and endless conversations with Mick. And we wanted to recapture in this place the four great rituals of the Irish and the African wake. The first is the pouring of libation and the prayers, and his drum and rhythm was like the saying of the rosary, the cleansing of the body, and the meditation. The words are, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my Redeemer. And so we hope that these words, these thoughts, these rhythms and music, following the wake games of the Afro-Caribbean and the Irish, the Afro-Gaelic rhythms that would have met in a building like this, as the cultures would have laid out their dead in the parlor, and their songs and rhythms would have bled through the walls. The neighbors would have heard the wailing of the women, and they would have come to sit, to wait, and to watch. The scripture says, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And so we will start in the tradition of weeping and keening with a song that Mick and I love so much, Stephen Foster's Hard Times. And I've asked Liz if she will join the ritual and begin with the ritual of keening.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears, while we all sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, our times come again no more. Tis the song. The world.
That was powerful, and I know it was very powerful in this space, and I hope that people viewing this evening, if you got even a fraction of the emotion in that and the rawness in it, what a beautiful way to open up musically for Mick.
I would like to ask Liz if she would say a few words. One of the things that Mick Maloney did was to bring together people. He taught us the power of convening, and he brought so many wonderful spirits together through his magic. Liz's voice lingers in my ear long after she is gone, and I'll ask Liz if she'll say a few words of condolence.
There are so many words and no words for how I feel, but Mick was someone that I met when I was just moved to New York and starting college, and members of my community and my family told me to look him up. So I signed up for his Intro to Celtic Music History course and learned about keening and learned about all kinds of things that we'll talk about here today. And I couldn't have imagined where my life was going to go, how it would have pivoted, how it pivoted at that moment, meeting him. So, yeah.
I guess if we know I know everybody in this room only through Mick.
Yeah. It's true.
I wouldn't know anybody here.
We wouldn't know anyone here if it weren't for Mick. It's
we've
true.
All come together. As a matter of fact, I traveled with Mick for 35 years. People used to ask me all the time, what do you do? What instrument do you play? Oh, I don't play an instrument. Oh, what song do you sing? Oh, I don't sing a song. I carry the extra strings for the band, you know. The Irish Wake was full of jokes. It was full of humor. It was neighbors bringing dishes from all over a tenement building like this, coming and sitting with the family for a while. We can think of no better song of visitation than to ask Brenda if she will sing for us McNally's Royal Flat.
Yeah, I'll give it a go. It's very strange to be singing Mick's songs. This is one really associated with him, really. Maybe the song most associated with Mick, maybe, in some ways. Does anyone else sing it? I mean, probably not. Did they? Oh, good. That's good. I'm glad it's getting out there.
Mick and I were working.
That's down to Mick, though.
Mick and I were working on this song because of our love affair with Harrigan and Hart. And we were unfolding the songs of Harrigan and Hart, but we always use this as our theme song and our encore. So
well, you might help me with the words then.
We'll all work together.
Down in Bottle Alley lived Timothy McNally, a decent politician and a gentleman at that. Beloved by all the neighbors, the gossens and the babies that occupy a building called McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats, all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats. That great conglomeration of men from every nation, the Tower of Babylonian, it couldn't equal that. A peculiar institution of brogues without dilution, they rattled on together in McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats, all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats. And tramps and other schlepers, Italian lazzaronis and lots of hungry cats, and lying there on benches and dying there by inches of the open ventilation in McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats. It never was expected that the rent would be collected. They levied on the furniture, the bedding and the slats. And then you'd see them rally as they battled down the alley, evicted from the building called McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats, all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats.
Irish wake and the African wake, particularly the Georgia Sea Islands, the New Orleans, the Carolinas, have this tradition called the Hour of the Wolf. And at the Hour of the Wolf, the men who stayed all night, the women went home to prepare the repast dinner, the men at 3 o'clock in the morning, Miriam, would take the door off its hinges, and they would take the corpse off of the bed in the front parlor, place it on the door, and then they would dance on their heels, a clog, with the door rested on their toes, so that the body jumped as they clogged around the room, and they danced the corpse for one last dance. You know, one great tradition that we had, and one that I enjoyed so much when we all toured Cuba together, was ending our pieces with the boatman song. Mick and I had a deal. He said, "Len, I'll sing McNally's Row of Flats if you dance the boatman song." Mm-hmm. Well, Mick can't sing that anymore, and I can't dance it anymore. But maybe our good friends will take us around the room one last time. John came.
Lenny, we're at a crossroads here in terms of celebrating mixed life, and here in the Tenement Museum and all that went on here, McNally's Row Flats, and the work that you and Mick have done for so many years, that theme of crossroads and sharing space and sharing intellectual musings and explorations has just been so part of what you've done, part of your DNA and part of the legacy of what you and Mick have accomplished. How do you look back on that work and how you see it for the future, or how it's celebrated in this tremendous talent and passion and rhythm that we hear with us this evening?
Our theme was Two Roads, from Robert Frost's poem, Two Roads Diverge in a Summer Wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it turned in the undergrowth, then took the other. Mm-hmm. And I always refer to myself as the eraser man. You know, everybody likes superheroes. Because whenever Mick Maloney called up and said, what are you doing on the 26th of June or the 31st of August, I would take out my eraser and I'd say, nothing, I am not, you know, that day is open, you know. We all did that. So I refer to myself as the eraser man. So I am standing now, good friends, where the roads will part again. And I'm thinking about this wonderful 35 years of all the places, Athena, that we've had breakfast and watched your children grow up. And yeah. Would you say a few words?
Yeah. You know what I remember most? And our homes, because this music happened in homes, in Irish homes, in American homes. And, you know, I spent time in Haiti and Haitian homes. I mean, folk music happens in homes. And all the homes that we've been in over the years, the people we've met, you know, the Shamrock House is like one home, right. You know. And then in Cuba, visiting different people and musicians and sitting down, having tea, cutting, breaking bread together, talking, connecting. What an incredible way to see the world and to get to know each other. I can't think of another community that is so lucky as us to get to have that window into people's lives and be welcomed as family. And that's what Mick was for all of us, is family.
Family. And you know, Dan, I marvel at you all, because after a day of rehearsing and a night of concert, then what did we do? We went out to a bar and played, yeah, till 2 o'clock in the morning. And the music and the fellowship was revitalizing. And would you share a few words, Dan?
Yeah, sure. I met Mick in, I think it was 2000 when he came to NYU. And at that point I was writing a dissertation about a traditional music in Jamaica called mento. One of the graduate students who was there said, oh, this guy Mick Maloney shows up. He's a new teacher here. He's starting a group called the Washington Square Harbor Chamber Orchestra. So I thought, well, I don't want to be in that. He goes, no. It'll be a good time. And so I go, okay, fine, I'll go. So the first year I played guitar in it terribly, and then over the summer I had a tenor banjo given to me, and I started plucking out the tunes that I was learning, and Mick took look at me in the fall when I came back with the banjo. He goes, Dan, you found your instrument. So I started, I got really involved with the group and with Mick, and he and I became great friends after, not too long a time. One of the things I really enjoyed was that, when I get interested in something, I get really interested in something. So I got really interested in Irish music. And then because of the group, I got really interested in studying, like, Irish-American dance bands in the 20s and 30s, which was the foundation of the group that Liz was in and Brendan was in. We did an album called Since Maggie Dooley Learned the Hooli Hooli.
Yes.
But Mick was... I know, right? It's a lot of words there. With the group, we went around, like, did a lot of things. Like, we played shows, and I got to, you know, research stuff, and I would share it with Mick, and then Mick would, oh, I've got an idea, and he'd share something with me, and it enriched my own research into the music. I mean, I never would have learned so much, and I would never have been afforded the opportunity to be as creative with the research as, you know, Mick allowed me and helped me sort of think about. But, like, you know, at the Washington Square group, you know, we played places like here, you know, like we played here once, and you know, Old St. Patrick's and New St. Patrick's and all sorts of different events around the city. I mean, I was like, you know, we financed our album by doing like little gigs here and there that Mick would get us, you know, and it was just great stuff. And you know, Mick was a guy who could pull together people and you know, make connections where you didn't think they were going to happen, and it was just really just great.
Mick would have had his ear to the wall listening to the ethnic rhythms coming from one side of the room and from another side of the room, and he would have been identifying those rhythms and deciding that he was going to go off to some place and I'm going to do the Irish and the Romanians, or the Irish and the Bulgarians, you know, like, you know, the relationship between their music. And it was really gumbo culture that he promoted. Brenda gave me my out when people ask me, what do you do with the band? I can now say I play the kazoo, because she went out and got me a kazoo so I could pull it out. And, you know, and I was going to have a nice little leather case, but we're at the part of the wake where we're telling jokes now, you know. Like, and Brenda, would you like to say a few words?
Yeah. Well, I hope that you become a top-notch kazoo player, yes. Lenny, if you're not already. I figured you had to have something to play.
Right.
Yeah, I suppose just we all say where we met Mick. It was a bit strange for me because I met him in Bangkok while I was traveling through. And my sister had run into him the year before and said, oh, that guy Mick Maloney, he's in Bangkok. You should look him up when you go out there. And I ended up just running into him, I think. And my dad's a banjo player, and we would have been listening to, like, Mick's Strings Attached album would have been in the cassette drawer when I was growing up. And Mom and Dad were the biggest Johnston fans that you could possibly imagine. I suppose, yeah, that's so meeting Mick. And I was writing a group email because I was traveling a lot around the world. And that year, when I was leaving him, I was trying to come home from Asia over land. And I included him in the group email, and I was writing from Mongolia and from across Russia. And so I think that piqued his interest a little bit, and he kept in touch and finally got me out here and got me playing and got me singing more. He was very encouraging. And the biggest things I take from when Mick died, the two things really are that he really wanted people to feel good about themselves. I can't emphasize how much he wanted that, even if something didn't suit him. And I have a few examples of that. He would sacrifice his own thing to make somebody else feel good about themselves. And that's not something that maybe we all do all the time. You know, I most certainly don't want that all the time, but I will more now is one thing. And then the other thing is he made stuff happen. And nobody made more stuff happen than him. Those are the two things I want to take from him that he taught me and carry forward. And keep the songs going as well. Keep the songs going, because nobody sang the songs that Mick sang. Nobody's singing them. He's got a whole repertoire that nobody in the world is singing. And so to keep those going is really important.
Keep those songs going. Miriam, when Mick and I were together the last week, we went to this barbecue, and as soon as I drove up, I said, there's Brendan. And I said, how do you know? So because he's a towering man, you know, his red hair and towers over us all. He's a fine musician. And I remember that Mick and I did this program called Black and White and Green in Harlem, where we played Irish and cakewalk music, Brendan at the piano. Also, our program at the Irish Arts Center on Stephen Foster, where Brendan was again at the piano. and quiet, gentle, towering man. Would you say a few words for us?
Sure, Lenny. Thanks. It's really great to be here with everyone and hearing everyone talk about Mick. I'm thinking to myself, like, what am I going to say? And I guess building off what you're saying, Brenda, the thing that really strikes me about Mick is how supportive he was of so many different people and so many different things. Like, I remember 35 years ago, when I started going to Irish festivals with my parents, Mick was already there, like, he was already a star, you know. But even as a star, he was cultivating younger people, Seamus Egan and all those people, and then Cherish the Ladies. That, like, there's so many different streams of music that are around now because of him. And not just, so there's that, but then from like an academic perspective, like everything that he did at NYU, he came along at the right time in my life, and I worked over at the collection there. Everyone should check it out at the Tamman Museum. It's thousands of records that Mick collected, memorabilia, sheet music, but then his own personal papers, like looking at the pictures of everyone he knew and everyone he worked with and everyone he influenced. He's just a role model in so many different ways. I guess one of the things that really stands out for me is how youthful his energy always was. And, like, even... I mean, that's why it's such a shock, is that, like, it just... He was tireless, like, and so young and interested in things. So that's what's, you know, that's what I take away. It's, like, inspiring to be... You know, in your late 70s, like thinking of all the things you're gonna do,
yeah.
You know.
Oh my God, yeah. The amount of things he had planned, and that's only the stuff we knew about.
Right.
Yes. You know, Brenda, I sat on a bench with Mick the last time I was with him, waiting for an Uber. He said, "Get out your phone. I've got to give you some dates, you know, and I want 5 more years out of you," he said. I said, "I'm not sure whether I've got 5 more." He said, "Just 5 more years." So Mick Maloney was not planning to leave the planet.
No.
I figured then that he got a gig he just couldn't turn down. It was so sweet that he didn't even stop to get his instruments. You know, he left them behind for us to take.
I remember thinking when he died and the few days after, just of all the many things, one was, oh my God, the amount of knowledge that has gone with that brain. That was really like all of the knowledge he had. It was endless knowledge and facts and information and just snuffed, you know.
He
imparted it onto his students.
But he did have the forethought to put together an archive with all of his interviews.
That's
all
true.
Of this and that. So
that's true.
We thought he was random, but he was a rather methodical man, you know. He was a rather methodical man. You knew him in a different way. You knew him from an academic way.
Yeah, and he was just everything that you guys have said from a musical perspective. He was just a force of nature at faculty meetings at NYU and sharing his knowledge. I mean, the interviews alone, Brendan, in the Archives of Irish America, phenomenal years of research there because of Mick that I think we can take some comfort in, Dan, to your point in terms of a legacy and his capacity, Brenda, to retain. I'll never forget seeing the first lecture/concert from Mick at the CUNY Graduate Center at an ACIS conference, and it was just a joy to behold. And
that's the beginning of his classes. You know, he had so many guests come in all the time, and it would be like name brand musicians who everybody would have heard of, and you'd never really know if you were a student who you were going to get on the day. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you walk in and, like, you know, maybe Gene Butler's dancing, and everyone's like, "That's the one from Riverdance," mm-hmm. You know, but it was sort of that level of sort of edutainment, I suppose he might have said, you know, where, like, you're really, like, you know, he can perform, but he can also deliver, like, a really amazingly put together class, you know. I mean, this it's the kind of thing that, like, you know, most, I mean, I would say, like, 99% of teachers just aren't capable of doing, mm-hmm. You know.
And also, most musicians aren't able to think about the audiences. Mick was constantly thinking about people.
His audience. Yeah.
Not just us up there and us having a good time and the music, but he was thinking about the people who don't know this music, who don't even know the difference between a jig and a reel, who don't know anything about this is foreign, and how are they going to hear it, and what could I say that would connect them to this song and that era, who's in the audience. He was constantly aware of his surroundings, of the context of what we were singing, of who we were with, of the time we were in. And so it was, he lived these two worlds, the musical world and the contextualizing world of connecting. And he used that big intellect and that amazing capacity of language and knowledge and scholarship to connect with people on a way that everyone...
The amount of effort he put into like every concert was just astounding. But he would be like planning like, you know, 2 months out what he was going to say. And I don't know if any of you had this experience with him. But, like, he'd call and like I'd have the same conversation with him that would change in very slight ways over the course of like the couple 3 weeks before the concert happened. Yeah, it was like he was practicing what he was going to say.
Practicing his delivery.
I know, yeah. It's funny. But like the other thing, and this is, goes back to the archives and talking about like, you know, oh, well, we lost a lot of stuff and there's still stuff around. Things. There's a lot of Mick in the emails that he sent people.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I've been going through emails, and, like, there's, like, you know, you get all kinds of, like, awesome stuff on them. But also his voicemails. Like, you know, I have a few of his voicemails saved, and they're just, like, little bits of, like, you know, magic that happen. And it's just, like, you know, it's just great.
For me, I'm at a loss. Mick and I shared literally twice a day imagery. We would find an old image to deconstruct and reconstruct. And this very morning, I looked at a slide that we've used of Jim Crow, T.D. Rice. We must have used that image, Brendan, 50 or 60 times. And I noticed for the first time today that he has a shillelagh in his hand. And I was like, oh, I want to call Mick and say, that, you know, oh, look at the shillelagh. And we would go off on, you know.
Yeah.
We would deconstruct and reconstruct imagery for the audience. And we get so excited that we kind of forget that there was an audience there for it.
I'm going to miss his phone calls.
Yeah.
You know, there was very few people who would actually call you anymore. Most would text, you know, or they'll email. They don't want to disturb you. Mick would just call you.
Right.
And it was so nice.
Yeah,
it was so nice to just get a phone call from him.
At
and,
like one.
You know?
Yeah.
At one in the morning.
Yeah.
Or 3. So I've got to believe, since the Mick Man was the gig master of the Western world, that he got a gig in heaven that was just too good to turn down, you know. And he had to leave at once, you know. And it helps me not speak of him in the past tense.
I keep on saying it, present tense.
In the present tense.
All the time, yeah.
You know, he's gone ahead to check out the sound for that great band that we'll all be playing in. One of the songs that we loved was Golden Slippers by James Bland. You know, golden slippers I'm going to wear to walk those golden streets. I know that Mick Maloney got his golden slippers because he left the gold dust.
And he always liked to go out on a high.
Yeah, and he did.
You know, he would always, and he told me many times, you know, the secret to life is timing. You got to know when to get out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he always did. He was very... You know,
he'd leave a session before it descended into a mess, you know.
And his career and his, you know, with the colleges he went and Elkins. I mean, he left Elkins after 25 years at the pinnacle of that festival. And he just had a way. And Mick, well done.
Well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah, yeah.
So I met Mick Maloney 35 years ago when I was a deputy at the National Endowment for the Arts. Our dear friend Beth Lomax, Alan Lomax's sister, called me on the phone and said, come down the hall. I want you to meet someone. I knew Mick Maloney from the Philadelphia Multicultural Festivals that he did. I knew his reputation, and I was in awe that this was but it was the most generous meeting of two souls. So we're at the point in the wake when dawn comes and we must walk him to his gravesite. There were two traditions. One was Celtic, which was that you brought a little of the dirt from the grave back to your home and you put it on your doorstep because the soul would want to wander to its loved one. The other was African and Afro-Caribbean, which was you zigzag back home so that you would divert, and you created great jubilation so that the soul would not feel sorrowful, but would know that you were joyful. It's where New Orleans gets its second line from. It's where Philadelphia gets its mummers band from. It's where the minstrels ended their shows with a strut. And I hope that you all have a tune that you can strut us out with, or a song that you can reprise that will give us joy in the morning. The scripture is, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning.
Lenny, I think one of the things for Mick was he was always very conscious of him being an immigrant, and here in the Tenement Museum, where in the Lower East Side of New York City, where so many people came together and crossed paths and shared things and reimagined themselves in an American way, whatever that meant. It's been wonderful and an honor for me to help out in this very special tribute to Mick. This, you were very special to him, and the musicians in this room were very special to him, and it is very, very meaningful for us to have this opportunity this evening to see him out and to think of him invoking, as he did to you and did probably to all of you here, that term he used so often, to mind yourself.
These are the last words he said to me, was mind yourself. So I leave with you all this thought. In an Irish wake, this would be the time where we would release doves in the sky, the spirits. Well, times got hard and they couldn't afford doves, and so they painted pigeons white. And then times got harder, and they had to eat the pigeons. And so they took out white handkerchiefs and waved them as symbols of the pigeons. And that's where we get the waving of the white handkerchiefs at the end of the wake. Let us wave those handkerchiefs towards, you know, and all of you wave your handkerchiefs as we say goodbye to our dear Mick. Thank you very much. And thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Lenny. And thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you, brothers and sisters.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.